This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Because of the coronavirus lockdown, we are releasing all sorts of special, unannounced episodes, so it's more important for you than ever before to subscribe to this show by going to reason.com/podcasts or to Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. If you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode. And the guest today for this episode is Dr. Jeffrey A. Singer, MD. He's a senior fellow of the Cato Institute, where he works on healthcare and drug policy. He's a principal and founder of Valley Surgical Clinics Limited, the largest and oldest group private surgical practice in Arizona, and has been in private practice as a general surgeon for more than 35 years. We're going to talk about the effect of the coronavirus lockdown on other types of medical care, whether some of the regulations currently being relaxed can just go away forever, and whether telemedicine is here to stay, finally. We're also going to talk about a great unspoken shift in the aims of the lockdown. We started out talking about flattening the curve so that our medical system could handle COVID-19 cases. Now we're talking about eradicating the virus and making sure nobody catches it. Is that possible? And if so, is it wise? Jeff Singer, thanks for talking to the Reason Interview.
I'm happy to be here.
So one of the issues I think that has kind of not really been discussed yet, but is important and becomes more important the longer that the lockdown goes on, is this question about elective surgery and other healthcare treatments that are being delayed by, you know, the focus on COVID-19. I've been reading accounts of hospitals that basically gear up so that they are, you know, they're ready for the influx of COVID-19 patients. And in most cases, that didn't arrive in the numbers that people were talking about, but it has also meant that all sorts of other healthcare just kind of gets suspended or frozen shut. I've read stories about, you know, nurses and doctors and other staff being sent home and furloughed because there, you know, just isn't enough work for them to do and everything is geared towards COVID-19. Can you talk a little bit about your sense of what's going on with all of this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those reports you're reading. In fact, in Arizona, where I practice, we have roughly 50% vacancy rate in all of the hospitals. And many of the hospitals are laying off or furloughing nurses and other staff. There is one 6-hospital system that my group does most of its surgery at that had decided to designate 2 of the 6 hospitals as COVID hospitals, which I think was a wise idea. They mm-hmm. want to have all of the, they want to do some social distancing among the patient population.
Right.
And they had, as of Saturday, they had a total of 25 patients for the 6 hospitals.
Wow.
And a couple of those hospitals had 0 patients in them, and they had 1 patient in intensive care. That's just an example. We're seeing this. The thing is that we, of course, expected there to be an onslaught. And in some parts of the country, as we know, in New York and New Jersey, mm-hmm. for example, in Detroit and New Orleans, more short-lived than those places, there has been an onslaught. But one size does not fit all. So differences in demographics, in population density, and lots of mm-hmm. other factors have meant that we've had different experiences in different parts of the country. Yet almost every state in the country has done this blanket lockdown policy, and governors have put bans on elective surgery. And so where you could, you know, argue that in New York right now, a week or two ago, a ban on elective surgery made sense. It doesn't seem in hindsight now to have ever made sense where I am.
So define elective surgery too, because I think some people, especially when these bans were first being discussed, they kind of thought about it like, okay, well, I'm going in for a nose job or something like that. You know, it's a kind of trivial action, but that isn't actually what elective surgery is at all.
Right. A lot of people mistake elective surgery for something to mean unnecessary surgery. Mm-hmm. But elective surgery just simply means that you can elect the timing of having it done as opposed to you have to get it right now.
So it's for example, it's a non-emergency surgery.
Non-emergency. So if you have a ruptured appendix, that's not elective. You got to go to the hospital right away and have surgery. But if you have, let's say, such a bad gallbladder condition that you're losing weight because every time you get pain and you really want to be able to get back having good nutrition. And you're also worried that maybe the stones from your gallbladder will get out and block your liver.
Right.
So that's something that needs to be taken care of sooner rather than later, but it's not an emergency. You're not going to, say cancel everything. You could say, look at your calendar. What's a good day for you in the next few weeks? That's the kind of thing. So, and there's, even among elective, there's a big range. So for example, cataract surgery is elective, but if you're an elderly person who's practically blind from it, then that seems to be a little more urgent than if you're just beginning to get cataracts and you got time. Hernias, sometimes some hernias are in, they're impending getting strangulated. Others, you could have them for years. So a whole lot of these decisions actually are a case by case situation that's reached by doctors and their patients.
What's been going on in your practice, or the surgeons you have firsthand knowledge of? Has their surgery practice pretty much gone to zero, or has it slowed down? Yeah.
Yeah, as a general surgeon, and which means we do a lot of, all ages, both sexes. We're not doing any elective surgery because in our state there's been a ban since late March. So the only surgery that's being performed in my practice is surgery on emergencies that show up in the emergency room, like a ruptured organ or something like that. And therefore, we have 11 surgeons in our group, and the older guys like me are staying home because I can't take my patients to the hospital to do elective surgery or to the outpatient surgery facility. The only reason to go to the hospital is to make rounds on the post-op emergency patients. Me and a couple of my other partners are in my age bracket. So the younger guys nobly said, why don't you let us make the rounds? Because we're less likely to get badly hit if we were to contract the virus.
Right.
Don't risk it. Stay home. We got this covered. So I'm actually having, I'm doing a lot of, going through my closets, getting rid of a lot of cleaning out the garage and that kind of stuff.
So
yeah, policy work.
What happens, so in the immediate moment now, or, for the past, month and a half and however longer this continues forward, we're going to have people who aren't getting surgeries done that would have gotten them done otherwise. What's the effect on health overall? And then, does this mean there's going to be a rush or a pile up for surgery, whenever the lockdown gets lifted for, in medical communities?
The last part of your question actually is interesting. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. The effect on health, it's really worrisome because there are a lot of, like I just mentioned earlier, a lot of people who, let's say, are, immobile because they have severe enough arthritis of the hip or the knee that they can't get around, and their knee surgery or hip surgery is on hold, or people who can't see, or in case of things that I work with, there are people who have tumors that need to be evaluated, and they may wind up having cancer. There have also been reported cases of people who've had their cancer treatments interrupted because some of the treatments need to take place inside a hospital facility, like certain kinds of chemotherapy or radiation treatment. So they're having their cancer treatment interrupted. And I'm just talking about surgery. There are other things that are elective too. So for example, cardiac catheterization to evaluate you for coronary artery disease. Now there are emergency cardiac catheterizations if you're showing up with signs of a heart attack, but there are also cardiac catheterizations that are indicated based upon some signs that your doctor is picking up, and that's not an emergency, so that's not getting done. And you got to hope that that whatever concerned the cardiologist enough to recommend a catheterization doesn't come to fruition before the catheterization gets done. There are plenty of examples like that, and there's evidence that a lot of people are getting necessary care delayed. In addition to that, doctors' offices have been telling patients that unless you absolutely have to come in, don't come in because you can catch COVID. And not every, even though telemedicine, by the way, is a great way to conduct a lot of these visits, not every patient, particularly the seniors, or not every doctor, particularly there are some old curmudgeon doctors who are not very tech savvy, have embrace telemedicine. So they're not taking advantage of that. So we're also seeing reports of a large number of patients who are not following up with their necessary follow-up appointments, for example, who are being managed for chronic heart disease or chronic kidney disease or chronic lung disease, yeah. And they start to decompensate at home, and then they show up as an emergency when that could have been totally avoided.
When you say they decompensate, you mean they either don't get the care they want, or they start shirking, you know, their whatever prescription drugs or exercise or things.
Yep. I apologize. I used the trade jargon.
Okay.
Now to say decompensate, we mean that the person starts to, things start to come apart.
Okay.
They start to deteriorate. They're decompensating. So they had developed a state of equilibrium, and they were dealing with whatever their condition is, and all of a sudden the wheels start to come off. That's, we call that decompensating.
Wow. With people in your practice or in your office and things like that, is the, you know, a large, you know, effect of all of this and of the lockdown, you know, for other businesses is that people are getting furloughed, people are getting laid off. Businesses may or may not come back depending on when things are lifted and, you know, whether or not any of the $2 trillion plus or almost $3 trillion in government money is, you know, going to float people until they businesses reopen. But with medical offices, is it easy to furlough people or say, okay, you know what, you're on vacation now, or we're giving you paid leave or something like that, and then we'll bring you back full time? Or is the disruption the type of thing where you might not pull back from?
It depends on the practice. In my practice, we have a successful enough practice that we've been able to furlough some of our employees and keep them getting their salary. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to do it as long as we can. But there are a lot of other practices whose, you know, their balance sheet is very marginal. Many doctors there are reports of doctors, particularly in rural areas, who are not doing well to begin with, who are either retiring or selling their practices and becoming hospital employees or just closing up shop. There are apparently a lot of stressed rural hospitals and rural clinics that were already having a hard time before this happened, and they're going to be closing up, and that's going to, of course, make less healthcare available to a lot of people.
So, you know, let's talk about some of the early on in the discussion. You know, there were a bunch of stories that had headlines, sometimes exactly reading, there are no libertarians in a pandemic, you know, and that this means we got to throw everything, you know, out the window, civil liberties, business as usual, all of this kind of stuff. And that morphed pretty quickly into a recognition that maybe there are only libertarians in a pandemic. As the FDA relaxed certain types of regulations, the CDC opened up a monopoly it had on certain kinds of testing procedures, maybe or maybe not. I know states like Massachusetts waived the rules they had about people who were licensed to practice medicine in foreign, and I was going to say foreign states and other states, you know, that you could just immediately start practicing in Massachusetts. You know, what are some of the regulations, medical and healthcare regulations that were relaxed that you think are most important? And then is there any likelihood that we will recognize these are not there for public health or public safety? So let's just keep them off of the books forever.
Well, I hope so. First of all, to your first comment, as libertarians, we would agree that there is a legitimate function for government.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, dealing with a pandemic.
This is it.
You have to list the things that a government should do, that's one of them.
Yeah.
So, but on the other hand, what we're seeing a government failure on so many different levels, it's hard to keep track. And there are a lot of libertarian lessons for the public here and that I hope the public learns. So just with the basics, you know, one of the legitimate functions of our public health agencies is to inform the public of impending problems so they could be ready.
Right.
So that came way late because we were told through February by virtually everyone in the public health establishment, the CDC, the Surgeon General, the FDA, they were telling us this is nothing to worry about. And then all of a sudden, at the last minute, they turned around and said, this is something really big to worry about. Then they were telling us, please don't wear face masks. And then they're saying, please put on face masks. Mm. So, you know, one of the functions the government is to do is to get the proper information out to the people so they know how to deal with this danger coming their way. So they failed on that level.
Well, what explains, can I just ask for, like, say with the masks, was that a question of them, you know, having the information, but then refusing to be honest about it for some reason? Or is it that they didn't really know whether, you know, it was a good idea or a bad idea? I mean, how much of this is an actual knowledge problem where nobody knows? And how much of this is just a bad communications problem?
Well, actually, a lot of it still is an unknown, mm-hmm. but we're getting whipsawed with the, you know, with the switching directions. For example, in Sweden, an interview of their public health director, Dr. Tegnell, who's sort of their Anthony Fauci, mm-hmm. he said they're not requiring people in Sweden to wear masks. It's up to them because they're not convinced there's any evidence that it has that much of a protective function. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we healthcare practitioners wear masks around patients routinely in the hospital, particularly in the case of a surgeon over an open body mm-hmm. cavity, because, well, for one thing, we don't want to get our germs on the patient. And just intuitively, it makes sense that if your face and nose are covered, you're less likely to inhale any droplets containing mm-hmm. these particles. So, but there is a debate about this, but it certainly doesn't hurt. Let's right. put it that way. It doesn't hurt to wear masks. And if the argument is we only have a limited number of masks and just enough for the healthcare practitioners, please don't take it away from them. That's acceptable, but that's not a problem.
Right.
So,
and
they
should have said that, right?
Didn't say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't say that. They said they don't work. Well, actually, we don't know. They may work. It depends on whose studies you read. So the right answer was, now that we have enough masks, it would be a good idea to stay on the safe side
right.
and wear one when you're in a situation where, for example, you're in a very densely crowded place, mm-hmm. like in a subway car or crowded elevator or a crowded room right. with a bunch of people that you don't know personally or well. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you don't need to wear a mask when you're all by yourself in your automobile, like I see happening around here
yeah.
when I drive, or when you're walking all by yourself in a city park and there's nobody around,
right.
you don't need to wear a mask, yet people are doing so. And that's, if they want to, that's fine if it gives them a sense of security, but I'm not sure it's good, necessary in that case.
So what we're looking at here in a way, and you know, and I want to stress, and I've known you for years, Jeff, and you're a thoughtful, serious libertarian. Neither of us is trying to dunk on the government here or anything like that, but you know, so there's this really is an object lesson in government failure at virtually every level. What are some of the regulations, though, that have been, you know, kind of willed away because it's so serious, we can't have business as usual? What are the ones that you're happy to see go, you know, particularly okay. as a doctor? And do you think they'll actually stay away?
Well, let's start with the federal level. So we have the FDA regulating tests and drugs. And normally it takes about 12 years for a drug to get to market after going through all of the clinical trials. And it takes at least a year for tests. Finally, when it hit the fan about the end of February, the FDA accelerated the drug approval process so that we have things like remdesivir, the antiviral drug. It's already on phase 3 clinical trials, which usually takes about 4 or 5 years to get to. So they're really moving that fast, which is good. And as far as tests are concerned, they eventually threw up their hands in mid-March and said, you know what, you governors, if you want to approve tests in your states, go ahead, do whatever, use your judgment. You don't have to come through us. Mm-hmm. So we have tests now available in certain states, like the antibody tests, that have not yet been made available for the whole country by the FDA. And some states are way ahead of other states for that reason.
Can you walk me through the argument, though, for, say, with remdesivir? Okay, so you speed up drug approvals. How do we know that we just didn't okay thalidomide 2.0?
Well, because they've already been through phase. First of all, when it comes to remdesivir, it was already being used for trials back during the SARS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out, we had learned about its safety profile pretty much, but it wasn't that effective. And then it suddenly became unneeded. Mm-hmm. So Gilead sort of had all that information from before. And the FDA said, you don't have to repeat all that stuff. We already know that. So proceed. So in that case, but generally speaking, once you've passed phase 1 clinical trials, and at least definitely partway through phase 2, you've already proven safety.
Right.
All that's left is efficacy. Up until the Kefauver-Harris amendments in 1962, the FDA didn't get involved in the question of efficacy. Mm-hmm. The FDA's focus was safety.
So you basically, once you could show that whatever drug you were, you know, talking about bringing to market, as long as you could show it wouldn't hurt people, you could proceed the way you wanted
to. And
that's, and from a libertarian perspective, I think from a, from every perspective, that makes a lot of sense.
And they deferred to the judgment of the clinicians to determine what's efficacious and what isn't. And in fact, you know, you can't pick up a medical journal or go to a medical conference without the topic usually being about efficacy, because that's what we that's what we do. We read clinical trials, or not necessarily even randomized controlled trials, but you know, doctors will report, you know, we tried this and it worked in this case. Now the irony of it is, we wait on the average 12 years for the efficacy trials to be complete, so that the FDA says now you the drug is approved for the use for condition A, whatever that condition was that it was devised to treat. Now, at that point, the, as far as the FDA is concerned, doctor, you could use that for conditions B through Z. We, that's your judgment.
Right.
You make the call. We're not here to tell you what to do. But we just told you it's okay to use for condition A. Now, it'd be reasonable to say, wait a minute. So I had to wait 12 years for you to tell me I could use it for condition A, but then you trust my judgment for B through Z. Well, why couldn't you just trust my judgment for A through Z and let me get working on this stuff 12 years ago? So that is a good question.
So why, you know, here, like, why is the structure, the approval structure set up like that? Since, you know, and I'm thinking about public choice economics, which would suggest to me the FDA has been captured by pharmaceutical companies that regulate it, you know, that it regulates. Why wouldn't pharmaceutical companies say, you know, like, we got to get to a place where we're just talking about safety and then let us deal with efficacy on our own?
You know, I'm not sure I have an answer for that. It could be that in many cases, and then now I'm just, you know, speculating, they've gotten very comfortable with the situation. The big companies know how to deal with this, and the smaller upstarts have much more difficulty dealing with it. So they're just comfortable with it. It's just fine. Now, interestingly, a lot of other countries in the developed world practice what's called reciprocity. So, for example, within the European Union, if the French version of the FDA approves a drug, then they don't have to go through getting it approved by the German FDA and the Italian FDA. They all recognize each other. In New Zealand and Australia, they'll recognize a drug approved by the US FDA. I think it's Singapore as well. I think this is not as good as it could be, but a good step in the right direction would be for us to do something similar. So, and especially when it comes to testing. So, for example, when we found out at the end of February that the one test that was allowed by the FDA, the CDC test, it was basically granted a de facto monopoly. When that was blowout, didn't work. A nice question to ask was, okay, well, why don't we hurry up and use some of those other tests they're using in Germany and Switzerland and Italy and South Korea. Let's get them over here because we already know they're working and we got to start testing. No, that didn't happen. It still hasn't happened even now.
Yeah.
So the best answer I saw to a question at one of these task force briefings, when a reporter asked, I think it was the FDA director, why didn't you use the test that the WHO was giving out to everybody? And the answer was, well, the WHO never applied to the FDA for approval of the test. It's like they were waiting for that. So, so you know, one nice thing to do is reciprocity. Now, we're sort of getting there, because, but only temporarily, because when the FDA finally granted to the states the authority to decide what tests are allowed, not drugs, mind you, but tests. So, for example, the governor of Maryland just last week met the Korean Airlines cargo plane at the Baltimore-Washington airport carrying 500,000 test kits from South Korea. So he's decided we're going to allow those South Korean test kits to be used in my state of Maryland. Now, there's nothing stopping the governor of Arizona, where I live, from saying, you know what, we're going to allow any test approved in Maryland to be used in Arizona.
Right.
And that's sort of a backdoor way of getting to reciprocity. Or, you know, it's but it's, unfortunately, it's only temporary. I would argue if these things are good enough to when it's an emergency, when we're really desperate, we suddenly discover that these regulations are standing in the way, then doesn't that teach you something afterwards? At the very minimum, when this passes, you should at least ask yourself, do we really need to go back to the old way?
Right.
Could we keep it this way? Or if you don't want to keep it this way, maybe keep it this way with some minor adjustments.
Right.
So you know, there's one example.
Well, you know, in another way, that kind of brings us to telemedicine, which is a different way of, you know, of delivering healthcare, or it's a supplemental way to delivering healthcare. I don't think anybody is suggesting, you know, that examinations, at least in the current moment, examinations over Zoom or talking to somebody on the telephone will replace, you know, physical exams completely or anything like that. But it's kind of fascinating that, you know, medicine is a massive industry, medical care, and it is very backwards in just the day-to-day delivering, the billing, the scheduling and all of that kind of stuff. Do you think telemedicine is having a moment now, and that it will actually, that there's no going back on this, at least?
I think so, but there are still some obstructions standing in the way. So first of all, I think patients and doctors are both realizing the value of telemedicine, and that can get healthcare to a lot of remote areas. Some of the incentives that have been built into our third-party payment system have inhibited that. So for example, up until this emergency temporary action by Medicare, they wouldn't pay for most telemedicine services, nor would most insurance companies. Some do, but many wouldn't.
Particularly with something like Medicare, which is, you know, the government's healthcare plan or insurance plan for people 65 and older, the idea that a doctor who might have been seeing a patient for years, and like, you know, when you need to get a prescription done or like, you know, just a basic check-in, like the idea that a patient and a doctor couldn't talk on the phone as opposed to schlepping somebody who might be, you know, might have mobility issues and then sit in a waiting room for a couple of hours, you know, with a bunch of sick people. I mean, it's mind-blowing that it wouldn't have been done first with old people, to be quite honest.
You shouldn't
honest.
Have to wait for a pandemic to realize the benefits of this. But still, even now, there are state-based obstructions in the way. So, for example, and the state of Arizona that I live in is actually pretty progressive when it comes to occupational licensing.
Yeah, very, very much so. Yeah,
yeah. They passed reform a couple years ago that basically gives reciprocal recognition of any license that's been held for 1 year or more in any other state to any person who moves here. So you don't have to go through getting a license. Right. Although you still have to have your business located here.
Right. And you have to pay a certain amount of money.
A license.
All of the, yeah, I mean, like.
But you don't have to wait 6 months to get an approved license and maybe have it rejected or anything like that. So it's, and two other states, Pennsylvania and Montana, have done it since then. So that's good. But still, you have to have a physical branch here in Arizona. So, but when it comes to telemedicine, you could practice telemedicine within state lines. So somebody living up, you know, by the Navajo country, where it's really remote, could contact their doctor in Phoenix and get medical advice without having to drive 6 hours down to Phoenix.
Right.
And that's good. But over the border in Utah, a doctor there can't do that. So you have to be licensed in the state. And I use as an example myself. Let's say I decided I had some esoteric health problem, and there's this guy at UCLA who's the world-renowned specialist on this. And I make an appointment with him. So I drive or fly to LA. I get an appointment with him. He sends me back with prescriptions and instructions and says, we need to touch base in about 3 months, 10-minute visit. I just want to see how you're doing. He can't, unless he has a license to practice in Arizona, I would have to get back on a plane and go back there for a 10-minute visit again. I can't conduct that follow-up visit by telemedicine because he's not licensed in Arizona. Now, that's actually a trade barrier because I could buy products made in, I could buy an Apple iPad. It's by Apple is licensed, let's say, in California. In Arizona, we have a free trade zone, except when it comes to certain professional services. So you can make a very strong argument on the, you know, the proper interpretation of the Commerce Clause, that is within Congress's authority to say, for the purposes of telemedicine, we define what's called the locus of care as the state in which the healthcare practitioner is licensed, not as the state in which the consumer happens to be residing. That'll fix it. Yeah. And breaking down this interstate trade barrier. Until that happens, we're still going to have, I think telemedicine is here to stay, but it's still confined to within state borders. Now, you could see how state licensing boards aren't going to be thrilled about that because they're losing certain control.
Yeah.
And a lot of state-based healthcare practitioners are going to be thrilled about that because now they're not just competing against other healthcare practitioners in their state, they're competing against all the healthcare practitioners in the country right. for service, maybe even the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that up until now, the largest share of kind of telemedicine was actually for counseling services. And there's a bunch of online companies that are pretty forward. BetterHelp is one. And I've actually used it where you can do video conferencing or phone conferencing or even texting, which strikes me as a bit, you know, less than perfect when you're, you know, trying to have a conversation about your, you know, your inner demons and whatnot. But, you know, that was the mainstay of telemedicine, and it was actually pretty successful. Is there a, I mean, this helps push that to the, you know, kind of to the foreground in a certain way, but do you, in within the medical industry, and, you know, this, we're like a decade into Obamacare, right? Which is kind of both was a big deal and restructured certain things, and now is kind of falling apart. Is there a felt need for reform at all? Or is it really, you know, the medical industry seems to be, again, it's odd because we have so many novel treatments, we have new stuff happening all the time, technology gets better, but then the kind of mechanisms of care delivery, I mean, it's like 50, 60, 100 years ago, practically.
Well, you know, you got two different types of people in the medical industry. You have some young entrepreneurial types who are trying to think outside the box and go outside this traditional third-party payer system, where usually either employer-based or government-based, mm-hmm. you know, in case of Medicare and Medicaid, and they're doing direct-to-consumer healthcare, whether that's direct patient care. They don't take any insurance plans. Of course, Reason did a great profile of the Surgery Center of Oklahoma.
Right, with Keith Smith.
Keith Smith.
Yeah.
And even, you know, there's direct-to-consumer laboratory. Every state except, Maryland, Rhode Island, New York, and New Jersey, everyone except those four states allows direct-to-consumer labs. So you can, instead of having to go to a doctor or wait in his waiting room for an hour to get him to order a prescription for your a thyroid level test, right. because you want to see if your thyroid level is okay because you've been taking thyroid pills, you could just call a lab and say, yeah, I want to pop in and get a thyroid level. And then if you have a question about it because you don't understand it that well, you could then decide to call your doctor and ask about it. Well, in four states, you still can't do that. So there is one segment of the population that's kind of going outside that tradition. But then, you know, you have your insurance companies, you have your hospital systems, and a lot of the kind of the, I guess you call it legacy healthcare part of the industry that is really kind of comfortable with the regulatory regime. They've learned how to work with it. They learned how to use it to their advantage, which largely means they know how to game it. You know, they know how to, once you master that coding system for billing, then you can actually get paid better than you ever did before, because now you learned there's new tricks on what codes to add that you legally could add, but you didn't know. And you also keep out a lot of new competition, because nowadays, even in my practice, we have three people whose job it is all day long is just to do claims, because it's so complicated now to file bills that we have to have specialists who we send to, they're certified coders. That's the real name for them. And they go to courses and keep their education up. We have just people, for example, just dealing with that. And we have another person whose job it is to make sure we're in compliance with all the HIPAA regulations and all the other Medicare regulations. So we have all these compliance officers. Now, we're a big enough practice. We've grown over the years that we can handle the payroll. But, you know, some young person just trying to get out there, that's really hard to do. So they wind up becoming employed by a large system, like a hospital system or something
Something, I mean, that happened to pharmacies too, right? Where there, you know, the pharmacies used to be more kind of small businesses distributed around the country. Now there's a few chains that pretty much employ every pharmacist around, and they're kind of reduced from being, you know, and maybe it's not bad for them, but they're reduced from being a small businessman or woman who owns their business and might grow it, to being a wage and hour employee with benefits, et cetera.
Yeah. On the other hand, we even have some disruptors in that field. I wrote a piece about this on the Cato at Liberty blog recently, and it was also picked up by the National Interest. There are a couple of firms that are actually installing kiosks. they started off doing this in college dorms, but now even in Phoenix, there's one at a busy intersection where you can walk up to this kiosk, insert your ID, and it's secure. And also your if you have insurance, your insurance card, and all that. Your doctor was given the digital address of that kiosk and sends in the prescription electronically. And then when you touch the screen, a pharmacist, which could be somebody who's, you know, in the house, maybe dividing time between homeschooling their kids and being a pharmacist, they got a little note that there's somebody come wants to, and that person interacts with you, answers any questions you may have about the drug, makes sure that the machine dispensed the right amount, and then you're on your way. You could stop off 24 hours a day on the way home from work or whatever. Wow. So there's another disruptor.
Yeah, I remember It's a Wonderful Life, and you know, where the pharmacist is distracted by news that his son has been killed in World War II and ends up pouring poison into his pills. So I don't know if I want a pharmacist who's also homeschooling their kid at the same time.
Well, but my point was that you don't have to be a you don't have to be a full time worker. You could be like the word is escaping me now. Gig economy.
Yeah, that's kind of great. Well, here's you've been practicing medicine what, since like the 70s? Is that right?
Since the early 80s.
Okay, early 80s. You know, do you find that events and obviously the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdown especially is really, I don't remember anything like this in my life before, but do these kinds of events tend to spur lasting change in medicine, or is it really just kind of like, you know, in another year or two or whenever, we'll have forgotten this all ever happened and all of the policy changes or discussions just disappear too?
Well, you know, this is unprecedented. So in my almost 39 years in practice, I've never seen a lockdown. I've never seen, and we've had pandemics, and I've never seen us deal with a pandemic this way. So I can't say with certainty. I can say that when you see, first of all, I think telemedicine has definitely left an imprint, and that's something that's gotten legs now. I would hope that everybody has learned how we can deregulate a lot of things. We also got to get rid of occupational licensing laws that are obstructing the free flow of workers of any type from one place to another. So I would hope some of these things will be lasting. Sometimes you can get cynical when you see what's happened in the past and see us just fall back to our old ways. But the other thing that's kind of curious to me about this, you know, in the past, it's not unusual to, you know, flatten the curve.
Right.
Okay. The concept of flattening the curve is not an alien concept to healthcare practitioners.
And that, I mean, I think everybody who is following this large story understands what that means. But flattening the curve means when a serious epidemic or pandemic or infection, you know, is coursing through a particular group of people, you try to minimize the intensity of the infection at any moment so that your healthcare workers and system can handle the number of cases that are presented.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So every few years, you know, we get word, the CDC sends word out to public health systems and hospital systems that they're expecting, let's say, an unusually bad flu season this year. And it's very common for the hospitals that we work at to send out memos to the medical staff saying, we're expecting, you know, these 2 months are going to be hell. So please use our facilities very judiciously. If you're planning elective procedures, bear in mind that we may not be able to handle everything. So try to be really discriminating in what you're going to do right now, what could wait. Help us out here. And of course, we always do because you know, that's part of being a part of the medical community. So we do that. And of course, because this is all being handled sort of on the local level with local knowledge, you know, in one city in the state, things may, the storm may pass, the worst of the storm may pass quicker than in other parts of the state. And so in those areas, the hospitals may tell their medical staff, okay, it's getting better now. So you can start feel more comfortable by bringing more people here. Whereas in other parts of the state, they may not say that. So that's, we're used to that.
Right.
And so when we heard, got word that there's a brand new virus that has not, no human's been exposed to up until now. So there's no possibility anybody's developed any sort of immunity to it. And it's about to hit us. And we believe it's highly contagious, more than the flu, more deadly. and it's going to hit us really rapidly, we want to flatten the curve. So I was totally on board with that. I am on board with that. That makes perfect sense. It's consistent with everything that I know about previous pandemics. Somehow in the last few weeks, and this is what's concerning me, the conversation has shifted because we've been successful mainly through private initiatives, by the way. Before the governor started locking down states, most businesses were having their employees work remotely. The professional sports was canceling events. South by Southwest, all these kind of things were happening. Movie theaters, they were doing this without anybody telling them because nobody wants to get sick or make other people sick. So they were doing it anyway. But so it's clear that everybody has done the right thing, and it looks like we flattened the curve. In some areas of the country, they never really got any sort of onslaught. Again, probably because of demographics, population differences, et cetera. In other parts of the country, like New York, New Jersey, they got it, but now it seems like the worst is over, and things, they even have vacant beds and excess ventilators that they're now giving to other places. So that's passed. So suddenly the subject, the goal, it's like a mission creep or something. It's shifted to, well, you can't go out now. You're liable to catch the virus. And I'm thinking as a doctor, well, wait a minute. Of course you might catch the virus if you go out. That's what happens when new viruses appear on the scene. I mean, that's viruses. Yeah. Viruses are with us. They're part of our ecosystem. And until you reach a point where enough people have developed immunity either by getting vaccinated or by getting exposed to it or a combination of the two, it's going to continue to haunt us. I mean, we're recently, as more and more people have suddenly refused to get vaccinated, we're starting to see cases of measles on the scene again, right? In thousands of cases after we thought we wiped out measles about 20 years ago. And then in the Philippines, they thought they wiped out polio 20 years ago, but their population decided they want to get vaccinated more. Now they've been having an outbreak of polio in the Philippines. So polio, that was the 1960s, right? And measles, you know, that was definitely 20th century, late 20th century stuff, but they're still here with us. Right. So as soon as you give them an opening, they resurface. So the idea that we're going to change our goal to getting rid of the virus, that's just not compatible with nature. It's not realistic. Our goal should be...
Okay. Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Our goal should be not eradication. It should be...
It should be mitigation and basically being smart. So, for example, it looks like at least 20% of the people who've succumbed to this virus live in nursing homes. So you want to protect the most vulnerable people. And you don't just have, not just talking about nursing home patients, but you're talking about people in confined places like in prisons or people who happen to have pre-existing health conditions or immunodeficiencies that put them at risk. But it seems like 80% of the population who has died is over the age of 65. Yeah. So if you're over 65, I don't know, you could be a really healthy 70-year-old, but you should start thinking about whether or not you should avoid staying in crowds, being with people. And if you're a friend or relative of somebody that age, you might want to not visit them because you might be afraid of giving it. So I'm not saying we shouldn't social distance. We should. I never was a fan of shaking hands. I'm a surgeon, so I'm a germaphobe anyway. Yeah. So I'm all for, you know, elbow bumps and stuff like that. Avoid it, maybe for the time being until herd immunity is reached. I think it'd be a good idea to wear masks in crowded situations like subway cars or crowded elevators or any crowded public place. But otherwise, I think we need to get out there. And I saw a piece that you wrote today based on this New York Times editorial that, you know, the young people should get out there because they seem to be at the lowest risk. And they also seem to stand the most to lose by the lockdown. And I think that makes sense. In Sweden, for example, which seems to have a very sensible approach in my mind, during this pandemic, they closed down the high schools and universities, and they're having those students take their courses from home remotely. But they kept the primary schools open. And when asked about that, Dr. Tegnell said in an interview about 10 days ago by the German Marshall Fund, he said, well, we know that the younger children, number one, are seemingly, for some reason, they're seemingly not harmed by this. Either they don't get it or they get it very mildly, number one. Number two, public health involves more than just dealing with this virus. And at this young, crucial age, This is crucial to cognitive development and the development of social skills, and missing out on early education could have long-term public health consequences to the mental well-being of these young children. So we thought, let's, since these young children are not at any significant risk, let the trade-off is more in the favor of them going to school than in favor of them staying home. And then as a secondary reason, Dr. Technell said, if they're home, then their parents have to be home with them to homeschool them. And that means they can't go to work. And some of them are even healthcare workers, and we need them at work. So that's another reason. But the primary reason is that from a public health standpoint, the disadvantages of keeping them out of school outweigh any advantages I think I got this wrong, but you know what I'm saying. The benefits of going to school outweigh any risks of going to school.
And of course, public health is never about one thing. It really is about doing that kind of overall cost-benefit analysis of what helps a large population be better off rather than worse off. Can I ask, in the United States, and you know, among my many kind of personal obsessions is a question of generational warfare. You're a baby boomer. I'm a baby boomer. How much, you know, the discourse in America over the coronavirus is very much towards protecting people who tend to be older, 60 or older, even older than that at all costs, it seems. And how much of that is that the people who are making these policies? I mean, you know, we're in an election year where, you know, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are almost 150 years old between the two of them. Anthony Fauci has been working, he's been working in public health since the 80s. Deborah Birx also, you know, old. I mean, how much of it is that the people who are kind of dictating policy, are older and they're actually kind of thinking about themselves more than making that kind of larger, comprehensive cost-benefit analysis?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, but you raise a very interesting point about, you know, objectivity. I think the way I see the discussion, at least in the public sphere, you know, on the media and in social media and even on, you know, cable television, I think it's more kind of a tug at your heartstrings kind of thing. Mm. Like you don't want grandma to die just so you could keep your 401k healthy. Mm. And, you know, that's, I don't like to think of it. I don't think of it that way, because the way I look at it is, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I've been a surgeon for over 30 years. So you can imagine I'm comfortable. Okay. I don't have to worry about that, but I'm worried about, for example, the single mother who just lost her job working as a clerk somewhere. And now she doesn't know how she's going to raise the money to keep her kid in a private or parochial school, and may have to send her kid back to that school in the inner city where they have to go through metal detectors. And she wonders whether, you know, her kid's going to survive one day. I'm worried about that person, or the immigrant family where everybody pulled together working 20 hours a day to get a small business off the ground, whether it's a laundromat or a tailor shop or a diner. And now it's gone after all those years. So to me, I'm thinking, nobody's thinking about that. And that's a very important part of the equation, because I saw a poll somewhere that said something like 75% of the people who can't work remotely are not college graduates. So people who are college graduates, the great significant number of them, they can work remotely because since they're college graduates, they have the kinds of jobs that can do that. But if you're not a college graduate, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
You're either not working or you're laid off or whatever. And nobody's thinking about them, because all of the people making the decisions and participating in the discussion tend to be the people who can best weather this.
Well, we are going to leave it there. We have been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a surgeon by trade. Jeff, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much. I had a good time.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I remain Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast and Reason's other podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts or going to Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. Thanks again for listening.